Not to turn there. Luke chapter 20, we're continuing a survey of the two letters, or the two books, that Luke wrote, the book of Luke and the book of Acts, written to Theophilus, and we're covering a chapter a week, and we've gotten up to Luke chapter 20, which basically is a very interesting chapter. It's one that at least interests me a great deal. I think we're going to enjoy our time together. There is in the morning sermon, which will be in the 11 o'clock hour. I appreciated, by the way, David's invitation lesson today and his efforts very much. So this is my first time speaking this morning. We're going to be talking about some other things that interest me. So hopefully they'll interest you as well in our discussion. But we are in Luke chapter 20. Okay, as I said, the 20th chapter of the book of Luke is a very interesting chapter, but chapter 19 was as well. We, if you'll remember, in our lesson last week, we talked about Zacchaeus, who was a favorite story for our children. Zacchaeus was a wee little man. I don't know how wee he was, but he was of short stature. And Jesus specifically approached him to go to his house. Jesus' purpose was to seek and to save the lost, and that was what certainly was accomplished in his death on the cross. But the fact that he went into Zacchaeus is something that angered a lot of individuals because they perceived Zacchaeus, a publican, as a sinner. They didn't have anything to do with sinners, and that very much was a contrast to the practice and the attitude that Jesus showed that we should emulate as well, but it was one that was characteristic of the Jewish leaders, of the scribes, of the Pharisees, of those who were in the Sanhedrin, which we're going to talk about a little bit more today. And as a result of that, he had a parable that he spoke concerning them and taught concerning the need to save all who are in fact sinners. But this was basically what we might say the pinnacle of his popularity. We also read about his entrance into Jerusalem, which we have termed, it has been termed by many as the triumphant entry into Jerusalem, because there were many people who followed him at that point in time and were excited about his entry. It may be because in part of misconceptions about what would occur at his entry, because they were looking for a Messiah, and in their mind, their estimation, the Messiah would be a king who would reign on David's throne and overthrow the yoke of Roman rule that was present. It was a very short time after his triumphant entry into Jerusalem that he was crucified on a cross there at that city. Because the Jews rejected him. But at this time, they cried out, "Hosanna, son of David." He had a great deal of popularity. He had pull with the people. And on this occasion, for the second time, you can read about the first time, I think, in John chapter 2. But here in Luke chapter 19, Jesus cleansed the temple. The first time was directly following his turning the water into wine in Cana, as recorded in that chapter, in John chapter 2. And now here, in the last week of his time on earth, we find him cleansing the temple yet again, which of course angered the leader. So that gets us basically into the 20th chapter, chapter 20. And we're going to be talking in the lesson today about some interaction with the Jewish leaders as a result of their dislike and antagonism toward Jesus and what he taught and what he did. So the first thing is a confrontation which took place in the temple at the cleansing of the temple. And we're going to read verses 1 through 8. Would anyone in the audience like to read verses 1 through 8 for our consideration? Luke 20, verses 1 through 8. Josh, would you please start off there?
When the chief priests and scribes together with the elders confronted him, told him the same, "Tell us all the authority of the doing these things. Who is he who gave you this authority?" The answer said to them, "I also will ask you one thing, and to me, baptism from John. heaven or lower than men. And reading among themselves, saying, who can take from heaven? He will say, why did we not believe them? But if they take from men, all the people will summon us, they are persuaded that John was a prophet. So the answer is that they do not know where it was from. And Jesus said to them, neither will I tell you who was, by what authority I do you say.
Okay. So let's look just for a few moments about a couple of aspects about this text. The first one found in verse 1 is who it was that actually confronted Jesus. These were not just mere Jews, common people. They are described here as the chief priest and the scribes and the elders. And so most probably these were representatives of the Sanhedrin. You look back in history, you find that that's basically what the Sanhedrin was made up of. The ruling class of the people of Israel was made up of chief priests, scribes, and elders. So let's define them. First, the chief priests. Now, there was one high priest, and there are other priests, but these, by the word chief, indicate that they were rulers. And in fact, during Jesus' time, there were basically 24 different cadre of priests that were each led by a chief priest, which made up the Sanhedrin. So there's a chance that there were at this time 24 chief priests, and we're not saying that all of them were there, but perhaps some of the more aggressive or the some who were appointed for that purpose of confronting Jesus were present. There is also that statement of the scribes, which were the lawyers. These were the ones who had an understanding. When you say lawyer, I said lawyer, so it's lawyer. I'm West Texas, so that's why it's lawyer for me. But the lawyers, they were interested in and familiar with the law of Moses. This was the Jewish law. This was the old covenant. And so they would not only be lawyers in our sense, but they would also be religious leaders. And they would be the ones who would be given interpretation, and this question would fall right in their bailiwick. Who gives you this authority? Perhaps it was even that one of the scribes may have been the one to fashion the question, saying, let's ask him this, because it was obviously an overt attempt to catch Jesus in some thing. And we'll talk about the reason behind it and how that could be in just a few moments. And then the elders were civil leaders. They were basically men who were considered elder, older, wiser, had positions of influence, who would be elected to the Sanhedrin and would serve in that capacity. So these were the individuals who came to confront Jesus. Not just mere Jews, but important Jews. Jews that had basically the leadership over the people and would be widely regarded by the people who were trying to trap Jesus in this question. So they asked the question of him, where do you get this authority for what you're doing? Now I want you to think, if there was a direct statement, which is what Jesus required of them in return, that it would have gotten him into trouble. Because Jesus was a carpenter from Nazareth. And so if, by the way, no matter what Jesus said, which answer he gave, he would be in trouble with them. So keep that in mind. If he were to say that what authority he had was from God, directly tell them it was from God, then they would accuse him of being a blasphemer, that he was claiming authority directly from God. But if he said that it was from men, which is the other possibility, well, Jesus had no bona fides in their eyes, in their estimation. He was just a man. He was just a commoner from Nazareth. He hadn't been taught in their schools. He wasn't among the religious leaders. And so they were going to reject him and claim there was reason to reject Jesus regardless. And so then we have Jesus responding with his own question. And that is about John's baptism. Did it come from God or from men? Now we know the answer because it's stated here that they gave. We don't know. The reason they did not know is because both answers would get them into problems as well with the people if they were to say that it was from man, because they considered John a prophet, John the Baptist a prophet, and they would not be happy with the leadership. You'll remember that when John was first on the scene, that he had a great following as well. In fact, he spoke against what was the corrupt leadership of the day among the Jews and got a grand following from the people. He was a troublemaker in the leader, in the eyes of the leaders of the people, but he was someone that was commonly accepted, and so they feared him. If they said that his baptism was from God, well, they did not respond to his baptism. In fact, you'll remember on one occasion when individuals came out to be baptized, that some Pharisees and Sadducees came, and John spoke in a very strong denunciation of them, calling them a brood of vipers because of their actions and their behavior. They did not like, nor did they accept John. In fact, John was beheaded by the civil authorities. So the wisest and safest course for them was to say, we don't know where it came from. And then Jesus responded, you don't tell me, I'm not going to tell you. So we know that that's the case, but why wouldn't Jesus answer that? That's the question that we have up on the board at this time in verse 8. Why would it be that Jesus would not answer these religious leaders on this occasion concerning their question? Go ahead, Rick.
In the power of authority, they're not willing to honestly answer the question.
That's a good point. It's kind of a situation. They put him on the horns of the dilemma. He put them back on the horns of the dilemma. And if they're not willing to answer him, he's not going to be willing to answer them either. Yes, Josh?
In their hearts as well, they want to accept as long as they don't have any of that. They had no reason not to be with them. And they had to do themselves and the miracles that they talked about. They had no more reason to not any reason to accept
it. Okay. Yeah.
That's a good point. And again, it was a legitimate answer, but it didn't fit his agenda to answer them right then because he already had on many occasions, and he knew what would happen as a result of it. So I want to give you a couple of points that I want to make in this regard. The first one is that, again, Jesus had already in his teaching and his miracles and his direct affirmations shown that his authority was from God. As Josh said, this has gone throughout his entire ministry. And there's a text from John chapter 5 and verse 26. As the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself and has given him authority to execute judgment also because he is the Son of Man. Now, this was something that was stated earlier in his ministry. The affirmations that Jesus had given concerning who he was, the demonstrations of his authority had established very clearly from whence the authority came. But they had prejudged that authority. All they were looking for was a reason to do their despot with him. And it didn't fit his agenda quite yet. Later on, he basically affirmed that. I'll just show you a passage from Luke chapter 22. This is two chapters later. And verse 66, at the time in which it was after his betrayal when he was had been arrested and being tried by the Jews on this occasion. In verse 66, the elders of the people, chief priests, scribes came together, led him into the council, and said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." So they knew all along what was going on. They just wanted to capture him. Now notice what he said. He said to them, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe." So that's basically what it was just two chapters previous where we are now. And then he said, "If I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." And then they all said, "Are you then the Son of God?" And he said, "You have rightly said that I am. You rightly say that I am." And notice their response in verse 71. Now this is the Sanhedrin. These are the same individuals who are setting this trap for him. They said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." He was accused of blasphemy because he has said, "You've rightly said I'm the Son of God." Or the Son of God. there in the previous verse, which is what they were asking in Luke chapter 20 that he wouldn't say. As soon as he said it, they had him where they wanted him. This was a statement, his affirmation, from whence his authority came, from who he was the reason he was crucified. And it was that they had to convince the people as well, and the mob mentality is influenced for that purpose. They had to go to the Romans to get it done, and he wanted to appease them, so it was accomplished. But what they accused him of is blasphemy and sedition by what he said. He was the Messiah. He was the King. He was the Son of God. He said it himself. That's what we've been waiting on. And so now we can arrest him and we can try him and find him guilty for what it was that he said. And that wasn't something that suited him at this point in time. And so he refused to give them that information or to answer their question. Anybody? Yes, Dennis.
He also did not want them to disrupt what he was doing in the temple. John 10 apparently was what he was talking about. They took up stones. He had to escape.
He taught every day in the temple, and of course until, you know, he had that opportunity until the time in which he was arrested. But again, just to note this, he's finished his Galilean ministry. He's now in Jerusalem for the last time. This is the climax of everything that is going on. This is the short time he has in that city to accomplish what he wants to do there before his death. And so keep that in mind as we look at the next few texts. So let us go on then to the second slide that we have here on chapter 20 of Luke. And we're reading here verses 9 through 19, which is a parable. Rather than reading the entire parable, this was an attempt to show the wickedness of the Jewish leaders. They recognized it to be so, as found in verse 19. Let me just give you a quick summary. Here we have a man who planted a vineyard, went into a far country, and sent servants to run the vineyard. And you had the vine dressers who treated them despitefully, abused them. And then last of all, he sent his son, basically saying, surely they'll have respect for my son. But they killed the son, hoping to gain the inheritance of the vineyard. The son's out of the way now. We will inherit the vineyard. So they killed him. And so that's the nature of the parable. I would like someone to read, if you will, in verses 16 through 18. 16 through 18. Thank you.
Ready? He will come and destroy those vine dressers and give the vineyard to others. When they heard it, they said, certainly not. He looked at them and said, what then is this that is written? The stone which is over the city has become his own. Whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whoever it falls, it will grind into powder. The chief priests, the scribes, that very hour sought to lay hands on him. They did teach him, and they knew that he would have spoken to them against them.
Okay. So let's think back for just a few moments, looking at the parallel of the parable. There is a distinction made between servants and the son, and rightfully so. In fact, all of the prophets that came under the old covenant, in fact, Moses himself is stated in the book of Hebrews as being a servant in the house rather than the son. So there is a distinction that is made between the servants and the son. Now one thing, Stephen in Acts chapter 7 for his teaching, one of the things that angered the Jews so much was his characteristic of them, or characterization of them, in verses 51 through 53 of Acts chapter 7, which I would like to read to you. Acts 7, 51 through 53. He called them stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears. He said, you do always resist the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom now you have become the betrayers and murderers. So Stephen accused the Jews of betraying and murdering the son. That's exactly the way it's paralleled, or it's written in the parable. He said, you have become the betrayers and murderers who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. That's a very strong denunciation. It's one that really angered. We're going to talk a little bit about Stephen's lesson in the second hour in just a few moments. But but it was something that angered the Jews, led to his being stoned to death. Now, I look at this particular parable and how it ends, and especially the response in verse 16 of these individuals. When they heard it, they said, "Certainly not." And I admit, at the first reading of that, it's somewhat confusing in the sense they say, "No, that's not going to happen. That's really not what it means. It means God forbid." That's another admonition that is given. It's also given in Romans chapter 6, where the question is asked, should we continue to sin? God forbid, or certainly not, we shouldn't. But understand this, as he was giving this particular parable, the Jewish leaders, they knew exactly who he was talking about. It was something that was unconscionable, unfathomable to them that they would reject the Christ. It is something that was completely out of their ideology, their view, their feeling that they had been guilty of mistreating the prophets. When they were accused of that later on, they stoned a man to death for being accused of it. These individuals, they believed, at least the majority of them, even though they would use malpractice, they would use deceit, they would use guile, whatever, they were keeping in their minds what was best for the Jewish people, and they claimed to be servants of God. And so when he uses this parable in saying that when the Son comes, who they rightly understood and recognized to be the Son of God, that's what was under consideration in this parable, they said, "Absolutely not. It's not going to happen. We're not going to do this. We're not guilty of this." And that's where the "certainly not" came from, which is why Jesus responded there in the 18th verse, or 17th and 18th verse, by giving this quotation from Psalm 118 and verse 22, "The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone." This is a prophecy given by David in the Psalms concerning the rejection of the Christ. We also find in Isaiah 53 that idea that he bore our iniquities. We did not love him. We did not show that affection for him. And he had to die for us. He wasn't going to come as that victorious king that would be received into Jerusalem as a reigning monarch and one who would reign physically on the throne. That's not what it was all about. He would die. He would be rejected. And who would reject him? According to the prophecy and according to the parable, the individuals who would reject him were, again, the Jewish leaders. I'm looking back because I haven't, verse 19. So that's what we went ahead. I meant 16 to 18. Rick read verse 19. So we basically answered the questions. Who were targeted by Jesus' parable, the vine dressers? Who was it? Okay, chief priests, scribes. So it was the religious leaders. They knew that the parable was spoken of about them. So anyone want to add anything to this section of our study? Okay, appreciate very much us making some headway here. So we get now to verses 20 through 26. Another interesting interaction that we can note, this time concerning taxation, another opportunity and effort on the part of the Jews to the scribes this time to put him on the horns of a dilemma, to get him to say something with which he could be blamed. So who would like to read verses 20 through 26 for me at this time? Chapter 20, verses 20. Go ahead, Tom.
When watching the Christian fire, he did those words in order to deliver them to the power of the following of the devil. They ask him, saying, "We know that you say he's righteous, and you do not show his personal favor to him. But teach the way of God in truth. You all show his compassion to keep him from wrong. And he received their passion and said to him, 'Why are you dead? So dear to hear that you can get any Christians that he has.' And he answered, 'Yes, Jesus.' And he said to him, 'Bring them therefore to Jesus the things that are here, and your eyes the things that are God.' But they could not take him in his word and bless him with Jesus, and all the way naturally."
Okay. All right, so let's look at this particular occasion. And the first thing I want to note is a distinction that I've been trying to make, and perhaps not done a very good job of it, between flattery and praise. Flattery is spoken of often as being negative. It is sometimes referred to being insincere, the motivation of which is to gain something for oneself, where we are told often to give praise. Praise to God, praise to other men. It's a good thing for us to do to one another, is to praise one another. But we ought not be guilty of seeking to flatter one another. This is a wonderful example, so we can see the definition in what was accomplished. As you note in this text, the clear statement, they watched him, and they sent spies. So these are spies that came to him. He was on the radar of these Jewish leaders. He was dangerous to them. He was unacceptable to them. And they wanted him to get in trouble. And this time it was not that they may make accusations, but rather that Rome itself would get involved. This is something that they wanted him to get in trouble with the governor of Judea on this particular occasion. So they asked that rather famous question about taxes. This was again flattery. It was deceitful. It had a motivation. It wasn't praise. And Jesus was able to discern the evil that was present. This famous question about taxes again puts him on the horn of a dilemma, because if he said yes, that we are to pay taxes to Rome, well, that's going to make him unpopular in some areas, because publicans were unpopular, Rome was unpopular. They were, in fact, grating under the taxation of Rome, and it might cause some of the people to leave him. It would make him less popular than he was. But if he said no, well, then he's a seditionist. No, we should not. And perhaps they thought, most probably, he'll say no. If he calls himself the king, and calls himself the leader of the Jewish people, we're under Rome. And while they said the same thing, we've not been in bondage ever to anyone. We are Abraham's children. They understood their bondage to Rome. They understood the filial devotion they had to show and what would happen if they didn't, which basically did happen in AD 70 as Jerusalem was besieged and the temple and the city was destroyed. So this was a difficult question to answer. This time Jesus didn't refuse to answer it, though. He had an answer that was unique and wise. In verse 26, they could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people. They marveled at his answer and they kept silent. Now here's the answer, very simply, and we'll respond to it in regard to the question, but render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. So the question that we ask by way of application today, talking about us in our nation today, or any Christians in any nations in our day and time, are we required by God to pay taxes if the government is evil? And we talk about just recently, since 1973 till recently, abortion was allowed, which is the killing of children. And there have been movements in the past that the federal government actually pay for abortions and federal funding of Planned Parenthood and other abortion mills. And while it has become no longer the law of the land, Roe versus Wade, they're making other laws by states and they're trying to enact a federal law to again make abortion legal always in every instance or every circumstance. So let's say that's in place. Do we pay taxes to our government if our government is evil? What would be your answer to that based upon this and other teaching in Scripture?
Yes, sir.
Oh, way more than we are.
Okay.
Way more than we are. Yeah. Anyway,
the
point here is, government actions are not in any way
so that would be their personal responsibility, and this is the correct answer to the question. Yeah, so let's just look at a couple of things. Rome was evil, as Rick indicated. It was as evil, if not more evil, than our nation. There are certainly many things that were present with regard to the morality. All you have to do is look at the latter part of Romans chapter 1, where the Gentiles were being considered in the list of sins that were present at Rome at that time. And you think, for example, the Christians being fed to the lions in the Roman Colosseum, the persecution of Christians a bit later. So what we need to understand is that God appoints and ends the interim regarding nations. Rome lasted 1,000 years. I forget exactly how long the basic time in which it was as a world empire, but it's much longer than what we have before it fell. But it did fall. So God is the one who determines the rise and the fall of nations, the time of their habitation. Acts chapter 17 and verse 26 indicates that. But notice what is said in Romans 13 and verse 7. Now this is under the Christian dispensation. I want you to notice what Paul says, that very, very similar to what Jesus stated on this time. In Romans 13, verse 7, he said, "Render therefore to all their due." And so we render taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. Now this is in the context, as Romans 13, verse 7 references the civil authorities. And so we have a responsibility to obey the nations, because these are given that man may not be guilty of anarchy. The nations themselves and their arrangement and all that they are serve a purpose, and that is to bring men to God. That's why God has appointed them, and that's why God determines their rise and their fall. And if they go to evil, God will judge them. But it doesn't change how we are to react to them. It's a function of living in the world. You might remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, it's verses 9 through 13, where the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to them telling them that they should have no fellowship with the idolater. But he's not talking about the idolater in the world, because if that were the case, you would have to come out of the world. He's talking about don't being guilty of having fellowship with the sexually immoral, the idolaters, in the church, rather they were to put them out. God's going to judge the world, and we are not having fellowship with the world when we fulfill the duties that God has given us to do. That fellowship is a spiritual commitment and a spiritual participation that only happens in the Lord's church. So for an individual to say that I can't pay taxes, I had a couple of young men. They were members of a congregation in Odessa, and they went with me once when I was going to preach, and we had a kind of a discussion. They were about my age, but maybe a couple of years older, and both graduates from college, so they were a couple of years older, and they were talking about how the world was so evil. Now, this was basically back in 1980, 1981, so it's changed a little bit since then, but talking about how evil the world was, and that they felt it was wrong to pay taxes. You're going to get in trouble if you don't pay taxes. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And they both claimed that they were going to move up to Alaska and basically get off the grid so they can't be found, so they didn't have to pay taxes to this evil, evil thing. They wanted to get out of the world. If they get off the grid out there in Alaska, don't see anyone, don't talk to anyone, well, they're not going to save anyone either. And that's our responsibility, is to be in the world and shine as lights in the world. But what it does not mean is that we have fellowship with the world if we do the world's bidding in the areas where Christ requires. And that's something that Christ expects with regard to a duty that we have. And we're told in Romans chapter 13, if we don't want to have fear with regard to the civil authorities, then we do what is lawful to them. And so he said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Paul said, render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. Okay? Questions, comments about that section? It's an interesting one to study, isn't it? Yes, please.
I think also there's a reason for doing that. When he said, so then you shall bear no other name but man, or the Lord's name. And this is the Lord God that by doing good, he made good, he silent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a good point. And think of it that way. Everything that you do, you may be doing it and fulfilling a requirement, but it makes it a little easier to put that check in the mail to the IRS if you're doing it to the Lord. If you're doing it because this is what the Lord requires instead of what the government requires of you. And by so doing, a slave... with regard to his master, an employee, with regard to his employer, when we are to offer up the service that we offer, husbands to wives to husbands, parents to children to parents, all of that kind of stuff, it first goes to the Lord. And the good thing is, as Dennis has indicated, it is accomplished when that is done, is that those who would otherwise be critical of us for not doing it, they have nothing to say because we are keeping those requirements that they would place upon us. Okay? All right, appreciate it very much. Let's go on to the next one. We've got a few minutes left, and we're going to be going to verses 27 through 40. Let me get to that one. And Jesus here is using the implication of Scripture to refute the Sadducees. And again, I don't want to read all of it because it's a familiar story, but this is the concise part. There was a woman and a man who were married. He died before they had children. There was a law under the Jewish law that his brother should take her as wife and bear children for him. So he takes her as wife. He dies, not having born children. Seven brothers, all seven died, not having children. And then finally the woman died. And the question is, by the Sadducees on this occasion, who did not believe in the resurrection, is whose wife will she be in the resurrection? So there are two arguments that Jesus gives concerning this. I want you to note verses 35 and 36, first of all. Luke 20 and verses 35 and 36. He said, "Those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, nor can they die anymore, for they were equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." And so there is a different nature. And I want you to understand this because people don't get this right today. There are no golf courses in heaven. Okay? And if you're a band geek, there are no football fields with bands marching on them either. It doesn't work that way. Those things that you personally have as this idea of what makes you happiest on earth, that's what you're going to inherit in heaven, it's not that way. The nature of it all is different. They neither marry nor are given in marriage or like the angels in heaven. It's going to be sublime. We don't know how it will be more sublime than all we think about because we are limited in our thinking. But the fact is, it will be. So that's the first argument that is made. We're not going to be that way. So this is, in fact, a silly question. It's a question that you thought might be a good one, but it's irrelevant to the resurrection at all. But the second thing argument he made, he emphasized the reality of the resurrection. It's found in verses 37 through 40. So someone read that for me. Rick, would you do that? Verses 37 through 40 of the text.
"Now even Moses showed in the burning bush passage that the dead are living. When he called the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all living to him. Then some of the scribes answered and said, Teacher, you have spoken well. But after that, they dared not question him." Mm-hmm.
One point to make, I want you to notice in verse 26, we are told that they could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people. They marveled at his answer, and they kept silent. And now some come again, and here we are told in verse 40, after that they dared not question him anymore. This shows the success that Jesus had in his response in these cases. So this is a successful argument. It is successful because these individuals, these scribes, who had that respect for the law, understood authority. Didn't always practice it, but they understood the legitimacy of what Jesus was saying. So as we look at the question, explain the significance of the burning bush passage, which is found in Exodus 3 and verse 6, as it pertains to the resurrection of the dead. Who wants to put that in simple terms? Go ahead, Josh.
First of all, it's an example of a cemetery. I am not a cemetery. Those men have died. So, any way that you can see God of the end of the time, it's a
Okay. So in a sense, they are alive. That it's an evidence of the fact that they, you know, the people will say that, you know, when I die, I'm dead all over like Rover. Well, no, you're not, because your soul lives on. and there will be the resurrection in the day of judgment. So looking at that, that's exactly what is the case. They were alive somewhere. And so this passage. Now, one thing that you'll note, again, necessary inference is the opposite side of divine implication. And I like to use divine implication. I used to use necessary inference all the time, but I've kind of gotten to the point. The point is this. In Scripture, God implied the resurrection in this one passage. It's a divine implication. In other words, it's there. It's not said in so many words. It's something you have to derive or infer from the text, but it is there. When God said, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," what he was saying is there is a resurrection. As he didn't say explicitly, but he implied that it was the case because their souls remain alive. They're not dead. They do not cease to exist at death as the Sadducees claim. Now the scribes understood this and they said, "You have spoken wisely. This is an argument we can't answer." And they dare not ask him any more questions as a result of what he said. It didn't mean that they were willing to give up their positions, but they knew this was an answer that they could not refute. Okay? Tommy's questions about this section. All right, that gets us then to the final section. We don't have much time to read these things, but I want you to notice in verses 41 through 44, Jesus asked a question of them, and that is that David, who was the forerunner of Jesus, that the Messiah would come and sit on the throne of David, and hence he was a son of David, replied to as a son of David. Well, David called him Lord. So how can he be both Lord and son? So what's the answer to that question? How can he be both Lord and son? Okay, when you're talking about son, you're talking merely about genealogy. But Jesus, in his position, surpassed David. He could be both Lord and son because he was born after. He was born of the lineage of David, so he is son. But he has been exalted above every name. And that would include the name of David. And so in that sense, then he was Lord. And then finally, reading verses 45 through 47. In the hearing of the people, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the scribes who desire to go in long robes, love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at the feast. They devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers, and they will receive a greater condemnation." So what was it about the scribes that he condemned, as given in this? Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. You'll notice in verse 47, that phrase where it says they, for a pretense, make long prayers. The word pretense, putting on a show. That's what that word indicates, a pretended reason. They weren't praying to be heard by God. They were making a long prayer to be heard by men. They were putting on a show for men so that they would receive praise. The second thing we want to notice is that they abuse the vulnerable. We are told they devour widows' houses. These individuals are in a position where they could take advantage because they were the rulers, and it looks like many of them did on that occasion, as they did in other times during Israel's existence. Yes, sir?
We see the same attitude and action from the religious leaders of the day. They're simply out to make godliness and start to
Very good. Very good. Okay, Luke 21, and our, I don't know why I got back, oh, I forgot to change it to Luke 20 there. I do that sometimes. It's Luke 21 is where we'll pick up next time.